How early would you say is too early at work to let your brain be in vacation mode?
Genuine question?
Genuine question.
I think it depends on your ability to hone in on necessary and important tasks.
Oh yeah, shit's getting done. I'm not in full screw the pooch mode yet. But the level of effort is dropping precipitously.
Okay.
Is it too early, or like should I give it just a week? All right. Just making
I think
sure.
You're good.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Good. Glad to. I wanted to check. I figured, you know, you'd be a good person to bounce that one off of. So thank you very much. I can say Ariel said, and I'll be fine. Welcome to Wherever You Are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada. You are listening to episode 324 of the MatineeCast. It's the movie loving podcast of the matinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. I know that as a podcast host, I'm not supposed to play favorites when it comes to guests. But screw that shit, because today's guest is one of my favorites. We first met 12 years ago and had our first spirited debate about 5 minutes after that. She's introduced me to some cool shit, some cool people, and some very cool ways of looking at the medium and the world at large. And she is joining us here today. She's a talented critic, a talented writer, and just all over an awesome person. Ariel Fisher is here. How are you, Ariel Fisher?
Well, now I'm a little bashful. Why you always gonna make me embarrassed and
because stuff? You're badass and people need to know it. Otherwise, they'll be like, I'm not going to listen to this one.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the compliments. Yes, I am a badass. I'm getting more used to and acclimated to accepting such
things. Badassery. I love it. Perfect.
To badassery.
Nice. Quick bit of housekeeping first. I am taking, as I mentioned off the top of the show, a little bit of a break. With that break in mind, I'm not putting the show on pause like I have in the past. What I am doing instead is bringing you fine folks three shows that will go back into some of my favorite films of the decade so far. The series is actually going to serve a little bit of double duty, since a lot of times, this time, we talk a lot about these films before many of you fine listeners have a chance to see them. So it's kind of a way to double back and talk about stories that you've hopefully caught up with by now. So this trio of episodes is going to be called Playing Favorites. We will start in 2 weeks with volume one on Nomadland. But first, we need to do this episode, and this episode is going to be a banger. It will be spoilerific, so please be warned. On episode 324, we will be discussing Love Lies Bleeding. Love Lies Bleeding is directed by Rose Glass. It's written by Glass with Waronka Tufelska. It stars Kristen Stewart, Katie O'Brien, Ed Harris, Dan Franco, and Jenna Malone. Love Lies Bleeding begins with Lou. That's Kristen Stewart. A small town girl in 1980s New Mexico, just killing time, working at the local gym. Into that gym one day walks Jackie. That's O'Brien, a broke bodybuilder trying to make her way to a national bodybuilding championship in Las Vegas. It's, you know, love at first bench press. But it's not all love and protein shakes for this unlikely pair. Problem number one is that Lou's sister is married to an abusive jackass who just happened to get Jackie her job that's paying her way to Vegas. Problem number two is how Jackie chooses to deal with problem number one. One after another, the problems twist into a rather gnarly knot that Lou and Jackie must find a way to untangle. Today I learned about the flower Love Lies Bleeding, which is an amaranthus. In Victorian times, it was a symbol of transformation and also of hopeless love. We see a lot of those themes in the film Love Lies Bleeding. There's transformation of bodies, and there's lives where both these women look to rise above their station, while at the same time, the love between Jackie and Lou seems a little hopeless at times due to the chaos they find themselves wading through. So, pop quiz hotshot, when it comes to the pretty flower of a movie that is Love Lies Bleeding, is this a story of transformation? Is it a story of hopeless love? Or is it maybe something else?
First of all, thank you for looking up the amaranth strain. I actually have seeds of this exact amaranth that I am going to be starting this week in order to grow outside, because they are beautiful. They're these long, drapey, red, like, they're fabulous. They're
very
lovely.
Weird, very sexy, very...
kind of weeping willowish.
Yeah.
They have that, like, drapey, kind of droopy appeal, almost like a cypress tree, although a cypress tree goes up. But regardless, same kind
I'll
of
I'll drop
length.
A picture in the show notes for people.
Is this a movie about...
transformation, change, hopeless love, or something altogether different?
Yes. All of the above. I believe that's probably the most aerial answer I could give. But it is.
Please go on.
With the physical transformation that Jackie kind of periodically undergoes, which technically is a psychological transformation. She's not actually physically changing, but it's kind
of. Yeah, I mean, that was something
And we'll get into that.
But. Yeah, gleaned as well, is when she really undergoes these changes, it's very Lynchian in that it's not actually happening.
Yeah, it's very much, it's actually interesting because the movie, it gives you the suggestive imagery of oppressive patriarchy. With the quit smoking tapes that she's listening to, that Lou is listening to. The way that the narrator on the tapes is talking about social conditioning, brainwashing, and everything like that. The way it's phrased, the exact phrasing of it, is very much likening the urge to smoke to fragile male egos. It's kind of hilarious how it happens, because it happens throughout the entire movie, and you know, Lou is trying to fight against that and everything like that. But what we really get from these characters is we have a bunch of women fighting to get rid of the bullshit toxic masculinity that patriarchy has wrought in this particular part of the United States.
Yeah.
At this particular time with these people, how this has affected this demographic. And the fabulous thing about it is that the people that it's influencing, the people that this patriarchal, oppressive societal norm is affecting, are lesbians. Yeah. Well, a lesbian and a bisexual woman. Mm-hmm. So that's fantastic, because I know we'd like to pretend that as queer people, we are somehow above and beyond patriarchy, but we're not.
Right.
None of us are immune to it. So getting to discuss it from that vantage point is fascinating. It very much tapped into something for me that made me think of The Last Waltz of all movies.
Like and the it was, concert movie?
No, the Sarah Pauli movie.
Oh, Take This Waltz.
Take This Waltz.
Yes,
that's the
yes.
One.
Okay, okay. Yeah, please continue. I love that movie. I'm all ears.
The overall theme from that movie of kind of chasing the high, chasing the fever pitch, adrenaline rush of new love will run you into the ground. It leads nowhere. It is empty. It is hollow.
Yeah.
But it motivates us to do so many things that have us turning our lives upside down and inside out repeatedly.
Right.
There's so much to this movie. And granted, I can't speak to it as a lesbian. I can speak to it as a pansexual person, because I am. So the bi aspect I can relate to. But there's so much here about lesbian culture that I couldn't possibly touch on.
Yeah.
That I encourage anyone listening to go and seek out articles written by queer and lesbian writers.
Please do.
About this movie.
Yeah.
Please.
To answer my own question, I'm actually choosing Secret Door Number 3, which you pretty much walk through right ahead of me. And that is that The Love Lies Bleeding in Victoria times was also a symbol of transmutation of pain. And if I can think of one thing that this movie is very much about, it's about the transmutation of psychological, mental, societal pain. and transmutating it into something else, whether it's chasing that high, like you mentioned with Take This Waltz, because in some ways that's what this movie's about. Like, here comes a new beautiful stranger into town and this may be my out. Whether it's going after the big prize and that's going to be my way to build a life, and I can get there if I just keep on like physically transforming my body into something that it is not designed to do on its own, and or, you know, taking a few knocks along the way, both physically and psychologically, and turning all of that into something else. I was really, really fascinated to learn about the flower and learning that the flower was the symbolism for all these things. I don't think that that's an accident. That Rose Glass named it after that, because it's not like, it's not something that's named in the movie. It's not a song that's needle dropped in the movie.
No,
it's a very, very specific reference. And when you take those kinds of things and package it all into 1980s America, which also not an accident, it comes out with something, you know, while at times flawed, really, really cool, really interesting, and for me gave me a lot to take away from it. We haven't talked about this movie. You refused. You gave me the zip lips emoji. Ariel Fisher. Yeah, it's Ariel Fisher. What did you think of Rose Glass's Love Lies Bleeding?
Oh, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I was completely enthralled from the minute the movie started until the second the credits rolled, and I didn't move an inch until they were done. I love Saint Maud, which is that her debut?
Yeah, it's annoying when they debut like that, isn't it?
Oh my God, it is. But at the same time, it's also just so, it's so invigorating to see such a strong feature film debut. This now, Love Lies Bleeding, has confirmed for me that I will always watch whatever Rose Glass makes. Like, without question, I don't need to know what it's about. She's just now in that category. So many flames on the side of my face, except joy. So
love it. Like,
yes, but it's one of my I hung on to this so much. So I've only seen it the once. I want to go back and watch it again and actually pick apart all of the minutiae in the imagery, because one of the first things I noticed that just tickled the heck out of me was the sign for the gym. You know, the symbol with the man flexing.
Yeah.
That's shaped like a uterus and ovaries and fallopian tubes.
Huh. The
flexing guy. I'm doing it, but this is an auditory medium, so that's not coming through to anybody but you, right? But yeah, the sign for Crater Gym, which is, or Crater Gym's Crater Fitness,
Crater something. Jinx.
That's the gym that Lulu works at. That is also the gym that is owned by her father. That's the symbol for it. Is if you hold up a diagram of a uterus with fallopian tubes and ovaries in front of that icon, they'll line up almost perfectly.
Yeah. Huh.
It's like, there's no question. They deliberately used that imagery, I think, because the entire movie is about the idea of feminine power, feminine beauty, feminine strength. But we have this physical strength that we're seeing, and it's so fascinating. I'm like, my brain is too excited, so it's all over the place.
I think I really want to watch this movie again. It's a very tidy little 100-minute movie, and it's got a lot baked in. There's a lot of very overt symbolism, but there's a lot of really subtle symbolism. There's a lot of themes to pick on and pull apart, everything from, you know, the setting to the characters to this whole world of bodybuilding and the way it kind of is this very interesting blend of masculine and feminine. But what does that mean? If you're a man who does something that is typically effeminate, what does that say about you? Or if you are a woman that does something that is typically macho, what does that say about you? And it's like, at the end of the day, it's like, well, it doesn't really matter, but it's an interesting conversation. This movie's fantastic.
The thing about the bodybuilding and the juxtaposition of predominantly masculine versus predominantly feminine imagery and behavior for me is this idea of Jackie's in control until she starts taking steroids.
Yeah.
And it's like injecting yourself with toxic masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
Like Lou gets her injection of toxic masculinity through smoking. Yeah. And she's trying desperately to unplug from it. She's really trying to curb that bad habit and everything, which she obviously picked up from her father, who we see is constantly smoking and looks like a leather handbag. With Jackie, it's literally steroids. She even says to Ed Harris, who plays Lou's father, at the beginning when she has her interview, saying, you know, I like to know my own strength.
Yeah, she responds to him when he asks what she thinks about guns, which, yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of guns in this movie too. Like as if there's not enough, as if there's
more
not enough
symbols.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. As if there's not enough, you know, pumping iron and 80s machismo going around, and let's throw guns into the mix.
Yeah. As many phallic symbols as you can possibly grab.
But she
not
says,
to mention the actual injecting, and you've got that.
Oh yeah, that like it's not subtle.
It's not nothing about this movie is subtle. It's about as subtle as a sledgehammer, but it's a pretty sledgehammer with glitter and rainbows, and I love it so much.
I adore this movie. Like you, I learned about Rose Glass from St. Maud. Loved the holy hell out of that movie. That has one of the greatest endings ever. It's got a moment in it that will absolutely take your breath away. Has lots to say about everything from faith to class to you name it. Jennifer Ely is in that movie, and anything that she's in, I automatically go see. So with my adoration for St. Maud, you know, securely in my jacket pocket, I took the walk up to the multiplex and sat down to watch this. I'd seen the trailer, I think, one time, but I didn't really know what I was getting into. At times it's brutal. At times it's very tender. It is
incredible practical effects.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It is like visually amazing to watch in terms of what it does with its effects and with its photography. It is masculine. It is feminine. It is everything just baked into a beautiful little package. And it's so bloody cool.
Bloody being a very specifically interesting choice of words.
Yeah. And that's like, I mean, thank you for mentioning that, because what I love about a movie like this is when it wants to get violent, it makes it count. You know?
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't just get violent for the sake of getting violent and drag you through the mud. It's like, all right, you know what? We're going to have this moment because, you know, that's why you're here. Let's be honest. And that's what you came for. Okay. It is vicious without being gratuitous.
Yeah. And it doesn't belabor the point either.
No.
So the violence that you get is perfunctory and effective.
Yeah.
So it's not like you have these long-winded scenes where someone is bludgeoned to death. It's a pretty quick scene.
Yeah.
It happens pretty dang fast. And that's what I'm talking about when I say, like, for the most part, the practical effects in this movie are solid across the board, through and through, hair, makeup, all of it. It's meticulously done, and it's just so good, including what is it, Anna Baryshnikov, the blonde.
Oh, Chekhov's lesbian?
Yes, Chekhov's lesbian.
We were going to talk about her, but yes, her we're going with her teeth, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Not just her teeth, but like everything about her makeup just left me absolutely aghast because it's so perfect. Also including her makeup in the later scenes of the movie.
Yes.
I was so thoroughly impressed and pleased with what the team did there. Mm-hmm. That was outstanding. Excellent subtle work. But the biggest one, the cherry on top of this psychedelically bizarre lesbian Sunday is what happens to Dave Franco's face.
Oh, yes.
And may I just say,
My theater gasped when we saw what had happened to Pretty Little Franco.
What had happened to Baby JJ?
Yeah.
Sorry, Drag Race reference.
Yeah. My theater was like.
Like I gagged. Not like actual. If you know, you know.
Yeah.
But I gasped. And I was not prepared for that level of violence.
No.
But also, it was so perfectly used. Like everything about this, it's what I have to imagine an acid trip feels like. Like it has to be, or mushrooms or something. It has to be. Because it's this wild ride that just fluctuates from scene to scene. And you're never completely sure if what you're seeing is actually happening or if it's happening
in a way, but the thing is like we're
is it tangible or is it metaphysical?
We're taken on the acid trip as it's happening, so it's like, okay, this person is getting beat within an inch of his life, and to them the person that's beating them within an inch of its life looks like a monster the size of the Incredible Hulk.
But she doesn't in that scene. That's the wild thing. When she goes, she does.
Oh, she
but
does.
In the actual in the actual act, she doesn't.
No.
And then it cuts back to her and then she does again. So we're seeing how she sees herself through her eyes.
Yeah.
And how she physically feels in her own skin when she's fueled by anger. There's a lot of that imagery that kind of that pulls from the Incredible Hulk. Like the references to the Incredible Hulk are unavoidable and clearly deliberate. And she's not actually transforming, but in her mind, because she's so in tune with her own body, she's so connected to everything about herself because she likes to know her own strength, which she tells us at the beginning of the movie, which is perfect because it sets up the foundation for understanding the character.
Yeah.
Because she's so in tune with her own body, when she starts poisoning it, when she starts using steroids in order to bulk up a little bit faster and all of this, and it starts affecting her mind, it just, everything just flips on its head.
So to stay on this topic, let's skip ahead a little bit. The repercussions of her murder of Franco is that she flees. She bolts to Vegas, even though Lou tells her not to, like, you need to stay here and lay low because we'll find a way out of this. But if you leave, you're going to take on blame immediately. But she doesn't listen because reasons, and she bolts and she goes to Vegas. And while she's on stage doing her routine in this very wonderfully crafted sequence where, you know, we are seeing the manifestation of all this work that these women put themselves through, you know, in these poses and turn left and turn right. And on the one hand, it's kind of male gazy, but on the other hand, it's also kind of not. But all of a sudden,
questioning that. Yeah. Where is the.
Yeah. All of a sudden, all in a flood, Jackie's anxiety manifests itself. And because this is a Rose Glass movie, and because this is the movie that we're in, it does not manifest itself in the typical dropping of sound and rising of heartbeat and, you know, hyperventilation. No. We have demons off stage taunting, and we have form created out of her body and spewed onto the stage, which, you know, we are led to believe is actually just she panicked and threw up. But because we're put back into her mind the same way that she was when she hulked out, it's this very body horror kind of moment. How did that work for you as a manifestation of the roid rage leading into anxious panic?
well, I mean, I've never had roid rage. And so I can't exactly attest to it from like a personal standpoint. But in terms of a manifestation of anxiety, it's beautiful. So often when I'm watching a movie and I think of what it reminds me of, and I'm, you know, pulling from the reservoirs of course, the hundreds of movies that I've seen, of course, of all the art that I've seen, of the books that I've read, all I could see was the scene of Weird Al's transformation in Weird. it's got a similar vibe, even though it's a completely different tone. Like, same vibe, different tone. They're completely different. There is nothing that those movies have in common, but there's something about the execution of the imagery that makes me go, oh, that looks similar and familiar in a way that makes me feel nice and fuzzy inside. But also, it's like David Cronenberg's sickest fantasy has manifested itself as anxiety. And that's amazing and frightening and disheartening and confusing, but mostly amazing. In terms of anxiety, though, it's fascinating watching how Rose Glass works. It really is. And she did this so much in St. Maud, and I was waiting for those little touches in Love Lies Bleeding, and they kind of pepper throughout, but she plays with the audience's sense of sanity so delicately.
Yeah.
But also so forcefully.
Oh, yes.
That it's done in these very elegant ways. It's perfectly crafted. But watching how she portrays the inner monologue, like the entire psychological process that Jackie is going through as she's losing her shit on stage and as she's trying to kind of regain focus and not be quite so overstimulated and quite so overwhelmed, juxtaposed with actually seeing the vomit on the floor. Like, it jumps between this hyper-reality psychosis and, which psychosis might be a bit harsh, but it's a hallucination by any stretch.
Yeah.
And the reality. Well, it makes you accept the reality. We can accept the reality that all that happened was she actually vomited. However.
Yeah, to her.
Yes.
Like, that's the thing. Like, you know, you'll hear somebody say, I felt like I had just blah, 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 blah. And it's like some very extreme thing that they felt like they had just did, when really they had just, like, you know, spit on their clothes. It, you know, like something like that. It's taking this moment that she has been building up to for probably years,
how long.
Months, yeah, for sure, if not years. And because she has just cratered at the absolute wrong moment, the only way to express that fully to us in the audience is she felt as if she had just puked up a monster and the monster turned into somebody she loves. Like, it's like that will take your brain and basically turn it inside out, which is the whole point. I believe this movie, in its moments where it, you know, where it kind of strays into the realm of surrealism, I think it owns its weird. I don't think that this movie is just being weird for the sake of weird, which a lot of stories do. They don't really have a point to their oddities. I believe that every time this movie drifts over into oddity or into kind of like, you know, some sort of hyper depiction of something, whether it's that red giallo lighting that we keep coming back to, or like, you know, a lot of the real close-ups of the muscles popping, those kinds of things. I think that anytime it drifts over into that realm, it's always doing it with purpose. It's not just doing it to seem weird or seem cool.
You're absolutely correct in saying that it's meticulously crafted. The best filmmakers don't leave anything up to chance. Like, and I guarantee you, the casting decisions here were also meticulously thought out. There's no irony lost in the fact that Dave Franco was cast as the character that he was cast as, considering his brother's history with allegations of sexual assault. I guarantee you that was probably a little deliberate and also a really great way for him to distance himself from his brother.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, we have Jenna Malone, of all people, as I don't want to say a pushover, because that makes that's really disingenuous to an the apologist? Character, but it, as an abused woman.
As an abused woman, but also as an apologist, as somebody who's like, yeah, no, I know that he did this and I know that it's bad, but he's my husband.
Yeah. And the apologist side of her and everything comes from, you know, you've got fear, you've got the patriarchal society that you were raised with, the way her father is. It's very Don Vito with Talia Shire.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
It's giving a very similar vibe, and Dave Franco is Sonny. And we all know how that went. And if you don't, well, you got an education to get, and trust me, you'll enjoy it. You know, it's all very deliberate. And I don't like seeing Jenna Malone in that position, because Jenna Malone is not that person.
No.
She did an incredible job with this movie. Mm-hmm. Like, an absolutely outstanding performance from her. And I mean, this is all I keep thinking about from her is if this is kind of like saved the later years.
Yeah, yeah.
Except not, because that wound up going well.
Right.
But
right,
in theory,
right.
Like, you know, I'm picturing stuff like that. And I'm picturing most of the things that I know her from, where she was fearless, even as young Ellie in Contact. You know, she's incredible in everything that she does, but she's fearless in everything that she does. So to see her scared is weird and unsettling. And they play into that very, very clearly. At the same time, casting Kristen Stewart in the role of Lulu, you have, she's a butch lesbian, but she's kind of, she's her father. Like, we're getting the imagery that she is this violent, aggressive man in a way, that there's this thing inside her that she learned from her father, this energy that she doesn't know what to do with.
Yeah, well, to put a point on that, every time, and it happens more than once, every time something incredibly violent happens, Lou knows what to do.
Yes.
Lou knows what to do very quickly, very thoroughly. And it's not because she's, you know, listened to a lot of murder podcasts. Lou has come from a very, very violent world that even though she wants to distance herself from, she has in her blood, and she just goes into problem solving mode of, okay, so this person's dead. Here's how we're going to hide this. Right. And it's wild because, while Jackie is the more physically intimidating of the two, she is not the one who's usually driving the car. She's the one who usually puts the car in a ditch, but it's usually up to Lou to get it back out of the ditch, which she does very, very quickly. So she wants nothing to do with that world. Like, she doesn't acknowledge her dad for like the first act of the movie, like doesn't even refer to him by name, doesn't, you know, mention that she's his daughter. But yeah, anytime shit goes sideways, Lou knows how to very thoroughly get rid of a body and clean a scene. And it's trippy to see Kristen Stewart in that position. We haven't talked too much about Katie. I didn't know Katie O'Brien. I saw her for her little small-ish part in the last Ant-Man movie. She's amazing in this movie. She's asked to do a lot of things. She's asked to be the Hulk. She's asked to be the new girl in town. She's asked to be the object of desire. She's asked to be the hired gun. And everything that she's asked to do, she hits her marks perfectly. I'm really, really interested in what she did in this movie and how that changed so much from scene to scene. Like, there's some scenes where she is, you know, basically ripping people apart. And there's other scenes where she walks into a kitchen, this big smitten kitten with, you know, the girl who happens to run the gym, and just elegantly moves from moment to moment to moment. How did Katie play for you?
Oh, she's incredible. She's absolutely incredible. I hope we see much, 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 much more from her.
I'm sure we will.
and the final product is outstanding. The final film is exceptional, and it's exceptional because of its various parts, including her. Mm-hmm. And you're right in terms of, like, when you say that she drifts kind of from one mode into another, she really does flow pretty seamlessly between each mode, and in a way that is genuinely impressive, because that is not easy to do.
No, it's all so cool. It's all so well done. And the thing is that as much as we want to give Katie all that credit, the reality is with every film, it takes a village. So that was, seeing Jackie have all of those moments, have the moment of surrealistic panic, anxiety, the moment of roid rage, the moment of pure smitten adoration. It's a feat of writing. It's a feat of direction. It is a feat of casting, like you said. And it all comes together and sits on the very broad shoulders of Katie O'Brien in performance. It's always so fun to see somebody new, to get away from the same 30 or 40 faces who we're used to seeing do these various things. And it's like, oh, look, Matthew McConaughey did something different this time. Neat. Cool. Very, happy for Matthew. All right. But when it's somebody who we're not as familiar with, it's like you're meeting them for the first time, but you're meeting them through a wide range of emotions. Mm-hmm. It gets you excited to, what else have they already done that I can go find? And what else are they going to be doing that I can look for? Because I just enjoyed that so much. Okay. We need to touch on this. This movie is horny. This movie is horny.
Oh my God. This movie is so horny.
Is this a movie that exemplifies the female gaze, would we say?
In many ways, yes, I'd say. In my opinion, the idea of a male gaze is very one-dimensional.
Sure.
It's pretty one-dimensional. It's been that way for a very long time.
Men ourselves are pretty one-dimensional, so.
I'd say as a general broad rule, the female gaze is pretty diverse and complex in that it isn't just one thing. It allows itself to exist as multiple things at once.
Sure.
And it shifts. And as it's shifting, that's still the female gaze. And so is this, and so is this, and so is this. The very nature of a male gaze is in and of itself a patriarchal construction. Mm-hmm. It's something that has been created out of heteronormativity and societal pressure from the patriarchy.
And objectification.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And objectification. But we unfortunately liken the male gaze to objectification directly, as if they always coexist, and they don't. Objectification, okay. There's nothing wrong with objectification, so long as it's respectful.
Yeah.
You know, there's sometimes you just kind of want to be a little objectified. I'm not, and that doesn't make me any less of a feminist. That doesn't make me any less of a woman. That doesn't make me any less of a queer woman. And Christ, I'm married to a man, so I present as being in a heterosexual relationship. However, everybody has wants and needs. And the thing about this that makes it so incredible is that it is in many ways very liberated. It is completely fearless as a film.
Yeah.
To be sexual, and to be sexual in a way that acknowledges pleasure in a real way. We have that's the sex scene with Jackie and Dave Franco. And that sex scene is, one, perfunctory, two, only focuses on his face. Mm-hmm. We literally see nothing else. You just see his face and his upper torso as he is humping Jackie. That's it. That's all you see. And then he finishes and we're done.
Was it good for you?
Yeah, exactly. It's that kind of perfunctory, thoughtless, mindless, whatever.
Yeah.
But then every sex scene with Jackie and Lou is kinetic. It moves, it breathes, it flows, it's fluid, it's ambitious, and it's fearless. Mm-hmm. in its pursuit of genuine pleasure for the sake of genuine pleasure.
Yeah.
And that, I'd argue, is the female gaze.
We're slowly starting to see more and more films by women arrive in commercial theaters. Like, you used to get something like one a quarter. And
yeah.
It's still a trickle, but the trickle is picking up. And what I'm enjoying about the trickle picking up is that you're seeing different films mm-hmm. by women. What I think was really interesting going back a few years was around the same amount of time, we got Portrait of a Lady on Fire. And
which I still haven't seen.
Oh, I cannot wait. And Ammonite. And they're very similar in terms of the core concept, not at all about the narrative, but just the kind of the kernel in the middle and the time period that they're set in, and somewhat in terms of the setting. But they're also both kind of horny. And one of them is directed by a dude.
Sapphic love stories.
Yeah. One of them is directed by a dude and one of them is directed by Celine Sciamma. And they could not be more different in their approach to, like you said, pleasure, exploration, mutual connection of, mm-hmm. That's the thing. It's not just about getting off. Not that there's anything wrong with getting off, but it's about actually connecting and seeing that dichotomy between that first sex scene with JJ, where there is zero connection, and all of those little snippets along the way of Jackie and Lou, and how they may as well just be like fused together for how in sync they are, even when one of them is taking the lead and showing them the other, how do you like this? And how does this work for you? And how do you do that? It's all just, it's not what we tend to see in media, in film, as much.
This movie really articulates how detrimental patriarchy is to everyone. Which is interesting because, you think of something like Barbie and you think of that being a much nicer hand-holding lesson in how patriarchy is just bad for all of us, no matter who you are, man or woman, non-binary, doesn't matter, bad. This kind of beats you over the head with it, but it's still a similar lesson. It's the idea that if we started embracing more of the feminine, and the feminine as it actually exists, not the feminine as we've seen in beauty magazines or as depicted by Emily Post or, whoever. The arbiters of femininity and feminization.
To take what you're saying there and take it somewhere interesting, what I think is really fascinating about this movie is for how ripped and how big and intimidating and imposing Jackie is through the whole movie, she is always also very, very feminine. There's maybe 3% fat on her body. She is just nothing but muscle head to toe.
Mm-hmm.
Which you don't
typically associate with feminine.
The world, you're talking me or the world at large?
Generally speaking.
Not so much.
No.
If you ask the average person on the street, think of a fit femme woman, they'll think of a yogi. They won't think of a bodybuilder.
Yeah.
And yet, even though she is a bodybuilder and she could break you and I in half for the heck of it. So would I. There is no question of her femininity through the movie. And again, female gaze, capture, performance, all of it intentional, like you were saying with Rose Glass and how this is approached. And I find that fascinating because it's not something we tend to see in film.
No. And we've been seeing a lot more of it lately, which is fantastic. Especially, it's interesting because we get these little spurts over the years where we get like bursts of more diverse filmmaking from, you know, filmmakers of color, from female filmmakers, queer filmmakers, trans, non-binary, you name it. We get these little kind of pockets where after people have been pushed a little bit too hard or a little harder than they're used to, mm-hmm. the executives have given in a little bit. Over the last few years, we've been getting progressively more honest filmmaking by and about women. Mm-hmm. And that is huge. And I'm not just thinking about this, which is, you know, Love Lies Bleeding is very much in a category all its own. It is fantasy, sci-fi, acid trip, romance, neo-noir. And at the same time, it's got, you know, white trash Americana and everything that it comes with. But I'm also thinking of movies like Bottoms and yeah, Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, and The Edge of 17, and even shows like Dickinson, which also we have
True Detective. Baryshnikov.
Yeah, but I was thinking of Anna Baryshnikov, who's in Dickinson. She plays her sister.
Right.
And also, again, thinking of the fact that she is Mikhail Baryshnikov's daughter is kind of interesting, because I didn't know that at first. But, and then you've got that dynamic with the casting and da 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 da. But regardless, all of these shows, all of these movies, and these are just a few, even something like Past Lives. Like, we're getting all of these movies that are very honest, earnest, heartfelt depictions of what it is to be a woman. It's not a one size fits all, which we've been saying forever.
Right.
But it feels like finally we're actually starting to see that. Oh, and even something like Shiva Baby.
Oh, yeah.
Another one that comes to mind that is absolutely brilliant in its depiction of femininity, being a woman, being sexual, being Jewish, like all of these things. And it's
being bi.
Being bi. The fact that we have gotten to a place now where something like Love Lies Bleeding can get made is incredible.
Yeah. To pivot a little bit, we have not too much talked about Ed Harris in this movie, and we kind of need to.
We do.
He kind of looks like Skeletor with a very heavy lifting mullet that starts.
He has a skullet.
Thank you.
He has a full-on skullet.
I knew there was a word for it.
Of course I know that word. Of course I have that.
He is grotesque. Mm-hmm. He is terrifying. He's intimidating. He is a shadow of a man in some respects. And he is the puzzle piece that fits into everything else so perfectly.
The bug man. That's an interesting... I so want to dig
nothing in this movie is accidental.
Nothing is accidental and everything is deliberate. And you have, you know, this man who is constantly running from himself and his own life and making mistakes left, right, and center. He's had to stay one step ahead of himself because he's fought himself his entire life. And he's created this human that he is now, this Skeletor skullet having bug collecting misogynistic prick. And it's this element of control with the bugs. He can control when they're born. He can control when they go into their cocoons, when they go through metamorphosis. He can eat them if he wants to. He can destroy them without having to put in any effort if he wants to. Because he has none of that control in the rest of his life.
Yeah. For as powerful as he is.
Oh, yeah.
And like, lest we paint, like, you know, we're not going to pussyfoot it. This man is very powerful in this small community. Interestingly underlined in the last act when we actually go to his house. You know, because that is a set, like, we've been spending the whole movie in these similar kinds of settings that you would imagine for small town New Mexico. And then at the last minute, we go to the Bugman's house and it's like, this exists in this same zip code? What is this person? And and how is he paddling in the same pool as all of these other people?
Well, the fascinating thing about even that is it's this manifestation of what men are supposed to be. They have to be the providers. Mm-hmm. They live and die at their jobs. Mm-hmm. They exist as like figments of their own imagination.
Yeah.
And, but their home is for the women. Their home is for the wife.
Yeah.
And their home is for the kids.
Yeah.
And so as soon as we set foot in his home, there isn't a single drop of him anywhere. It's all his current wife, who is not Lou's mother.
No.
Or Beth's mother, the sister. And everything that he has is shabby and beaten down.
His clothes.
Worn out.
That little trailer that he uses as an office at the gun range. Like that is an embodiment of this man. You know, his shitty shirts and boots, the way he wears his hair. I'm like, that is the bug man. This house is a complete facade for everybody else. That is not the bug man.
No.
So several weeks ago, I actually sat in an audience for only the second time in my life, watched some Chekhov. And I wondered, as I was watching some Chekhov, what would Chekhov's gun be in this production if it was even there? Spoiler alert, there was no gun in this particular production. It was Uncle Vanya. A few weeks later, I sit down to this movie. And what do we get in the very first scene of the movie but Chekhov's lesbian? The moment Baryshnikov shows up as this... my God, very, very, very horny girl named Daisy. Because of course she's named Daisy.
Well,
she is immediately something. It's like, you don't think that gun is going to go off later. But like we've said, nothing in this movie is accidental. No. So that lesbian's going to go off later.
Oh, yeah.
And that to me was like that. To me was the crowning glory of this movie. It's like that crush, that adoration, that unrequited desire was not there just to make it look like Lou was the only lesbian in town. Like that was something that we were going to come back to. And the way that we come back to it is incredible.
The entire movie is about the crutches we use to get through our lives.
Sure.
And the things that make us feel more powerful or like we have control over things.
Yeah, yeah.
With Daisy, it's not even that she's so horny, because she's not. But the only way she knows how to be valuable is to be sexualized. The only way she knows how to exist as a woman, as a person, is to be used physically. That's who she is. She's desperate and needy and insecure and in a lot of pain. Mm. But there's a power inside of her.
Oh, yeah.
When she flips the switch and she knows she's holding all the cards, she is genuinely scary.
Oh, yes.
And not just because, like, oh, she's going to go off at some point and we're not going to know why, but because she's in full control. Which makes seeing her at other points that much more heartbreaking, because you can see where the power is.
Yeah.
You can see what she has, what she is capable of, what she possesses.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also see how it's been beaten out of her by life, by everyone she's ever known, by Lou.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lou is an abusive partner in that case.
Yeah.
Because she didn't give a shit about her.
No.
She doesn't want anything to do with her.
No.
But she doesn't want to be the bad guy, so she won't just cut her off.
Yeah.
And now she can't because she has information. But
yeah.
Regardless, she is this. And I know that woman. I have met that woman. I have been that woman. Where you think that your only value is in how consumable you are. Whether that's physically or intellectually. Let's be honest, for the most part, it's physically, because that's usually where men, specifically in a patriarchal society, see our value.
Right.
And that's heartbreaking. That's a heartbreaking thing to say, but it's true. That's all this is queer women trying to navigate the rules of a heteronormative patriarchal society.
And in 1989, New Mexico.
Yes.
I think I've lost count of the amount of times I've said what I love about this movie. Because the way it takes everything you've just described about Daisy and her inner conflict, her role in this community, in these people's lives, and it puts it all into this one performance and two point of the plot, and makes it look like Baryshnikov dancing. Like, everything you just described is very complicated, and any move further or miss is going to throw off the whole balance of it all. And Glass nails it both in script and direction. Baryshnikov nails it in performance. O'Brien and Case do react beautifully when Chekhov's lesbian goes off. I'm never getting away from that, because I swear to God, that's exactly what it was. And it's just exquisite to watch. I guess the one thing I do need to ask is, does this film cop out at the end? Like, you've said that, you know, whether it's an hour, a week, a year after this movie, that Lou and Jackie are ultimately doomed. But in the moment that we leave their story on a note of connection. Given everything that they go through, do you think that getting there in the last act was a cop-out? Or do you think it's earned?
No. I don't think it's a cop-out. I do think it's earned, but I also think it's being misinterpreted. The movie doesn't end with them having their happy getaway. The movie ends with Lou killing Daisy.
Again.
She strangles her in a field.
Yeah.
No, Lou didn't kill her at the first time. And technically, neither did Jackie. She did not succeed. But the movie ends with Lou dragging a body into a field and then strangling her until she's actually dead, with the weirdest little grin on her face. And the fact is...
it's almost played as comedy.
It's not, well,
like,
it's not, though. It's played,
it's absurd,
seriously,
is what it is, because it's like, you know, you're watching it. You've got Jackie in the foreground asleep against the window, and you've got Lou, like, struggling to drag her out of the field. This exquisite long shot. It is a masterclass in composition. And like, occasionally she, like, puts her down because she's heavy, and she kind of turns around, like, make sure nobody's looking. It's capture, it's writing, it's performance, all coming together nicely. And like, and as you say, it's also very, very macabre, even though it's kind of funny.
Well, that's the thing about it, is that it depends on the mind that's perceiving it.
Sure.
I'm not even going to say it depends on the eye that's watching it. It depends on the mind that's perceiving it, because there are very funny aspects of it that are directly lifted from some of the great physical comedians like Buster Keaton, like Charlie Chaplin. No question.
Yeah.
There's also the haunting idea of someone dragging a corpse that is not yet a corpse into a field while their lover is asleep in the car in order to just kill them.
Yeah.
It's what you would do for your partner no matter what. It's the horror of what that is. And in a way, it's kind of an illustration of what her father was willing to do for her.
Right, right.
I think in terms of them getting away with murder, I think they do.
Yeah.
But the difficult part isn't getting away with murder. The hard part is getting away with trauma. and living with that.
We, of course, end every matinee cast review with a souvenir, something tangible or intangible. If you could take away from this movie and keep, you would. Ariel Fisher. We've talked about a lot of things, both tangible and intangible, in this movie. What would you be keeping from Love Lies Bleeding?
The Crater Fitness sign. I want some poster from that gym and like of the actual thing. I want like a metal sign or whatever from the outside of that institution to put on my wall.
You know what I would love? I think somebody should make it a neon one, but make the neon, make it either one of two things. Make it either blink so that, make it either blink so that part, you know, the uterine shape is highlighted, or burn out the neon that is not the uterine shape. So that, you know, you've got like the physical body, but then at night when you turn it on, it's like, oh, I see it now.
Okay. Yeah. That I could get
behind. Right. That's funny. I want a milkshake. Daisy makes that milkshake look so good. It is not at all subtle. When she's really keyed up, even though a lot of violent stuff has just happened, I'm like, I can go for a milkshake right now. I was watching the movie way too late to have one, but I really want one. I still haven't had one since I saw it. We rate on the matinee cast on a scale of 1 to 4 stars. Ariel Fisher, I'm sure people can hear in our voice. What do you give Rose Glass, Love Lies Bleeding?
4.
Yeah. This is a 4-star movie. Yeah. It is
3.5.
It's not trying to reinvent the wheel. It brings in a lot of symbolism without trying to seem too smart. Like we talked about, there's a lot of craft going on in this movie. There's a lot of nuance in this movie. And it's, even though we're going to talk about movies that it reminds us of, it's not anything I've seen before. I would love to hear what people have to say about this movie. Let me know. Ryan@matinee.ca. Twitter, I am matinee_CA. And there's facebook.com/darkmatinee. What do you think of Love Lies Bleeding? We are going to take a very quick break and come back on the other side and talk about some more movies. So come back. Ariel Fisher, I'm Ryan McNeil. We've been talking about Love Lies Bleeding, movie named after a flower. It's got symbolism. It's got all kinds of things baked into it. It's great. Go see it. It's the other side. It's the point in the show where we talk about other movies, further viewing, further reading you could do. There's really a lot of stones that skip over the water of Love Lies Bleeding, and not in ways that make you feel like the movie ripped off other movies, but just ways that make you think of these other movies and how they are spiritual siblings to this movie in one way or another. We've touched on it once or twice, but I kind of want to talk about Saint Maud. If anybody has never seen it, Rose Glass's debut from about 2018, I think thereabouts. Really great entry into the genre. It's a very Catholic movie. It's a movie all about class. It's a movie of a woman dying and the caretaker who keeps tending to her and their relationship and what each one is going through. It's a fantastic movie. If you've never seen it, it was Rose Glass's debut. You obviously love that movie. You're smiling.
Thoroughly.
Oh, really?
The part that really made, you know, you've said it's a very Catholic. You said Catholic, right?
It's extremely Catholic. I felt Catholic. Guilty just watching it.
Yes, correct. that is the emotion that she intended for us to have.
Yeah.
But
it's apt that this episode is going up during Passion Week.
That is apt. I didn't even think about that. Maud, our main character, is trying to save the soul of the woman to whom she is providing essentially palliative care. Mm-hmm. And what that means for the protagonist and how she is able to process the stuff she's done, the stuff she's felt, the stuff she's thought, relative to how to care for others and how those things have kind of bled into one another seamlessly and hauntingly. So the entire movie, you are wondering what's real and what's not, you know, more so than in Love Lies Bleeding, but very differently than in Love Lies Bleeding, because the whole point of it is psychological horror that's meant to make you question reality.
Yeah.
And it's meant to chill you to the bone, and it does that.
Because Saint Maud plays upon, there's been a rash in the last several years of spiritual horror, of sequels to long ago made spiritual horror, you know, your Exorcists, your Omens, your, you know, etc. It paddles in those pools. There's times where it's like, oh, Maud is possessed. While not explicitly cribbing from those films the way that some other films of the genre are so clearly doing. So that's what, that's the interesting difference, is in St. Maud, when things go weird, it's like, well, oh, the devil is present, you know, like her body is, her body is possessed. And yet, yeah. Whereas in Love Lies Bleeding, there, as near as we know, there's no devil around. So when things go weird, it's another type of weird. I think that's one of the things I love about Rose Glass, is she is finding different excuses to get the surrealism, the grotesque into these stories as a manifestation of something, and not just monsters or demonic entities.
Well, she's not dumbing it down.
Oh, no.
And she didn't, like, I think that's the part that you're kind of pointing out is this tendency that she has to just do whatever the hell she wants.
She trusts us. She trusts us to get it.
Yes, which is the way every filmmaker should treat their audience. And unfortunately, sometimes producers get in the way and they make that difficult. Whenever you get a movie that has fallen on its ass and it doesn't seem like it was supposed to be, things like that, usually that's because of corporate interference, not necessarily because the director's a big sellout or yada, yada, yada. There are contracts at play. There's a lot of stuff that gets factored in that actually removes the creative control of the artist. But if you're working with a really good team, which Rose Glass thankfully has done twice now, at least as far as we know, maybe it was meant to be a lot weirder. Who knows? I'm sure the special features on the eventual Criterion release of this will tell us.
Right.
It's like you said about the tropes, the imagery and everything from, you know, pre-existing films, like how we had, you know, The Others is a beautiful movie. It's an incredible, moody, atmospheric horror movie. And it is a direct homage and direct ripoff of The Changeling. It's a lot simpler to assemble a movie with imagery from other things than it is to come up with a legitimate story and pay homage.
Yeah.
Because there is a difference.
Yeah, there's a world of difference between homage and ripoff.
Yeah. And it's not necessarily, and sometimes the homage is really heavy-handed.
Yeah.
And sometimes the whole thing is just an homage and then it doesn't stand on its own.
Yeah.
That is not what Saint Maud is.
No.
Rose Glass was so committed to letting her hot thoughts out. Like, it's like every intrusive thought she ever had about any of those situations, she just put them on paper and was like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what this has to be. None of this PG bullshit. What we see in our minds is horrifying.
Yeah.
Put that on screen.
Yeah. You know, we start with Saint Maud. What were some of the other films that you thought that people could go on to after Love Lies Bleeding?
There are a few movies that I can think of that kind of pull on tonal elements or plot elements of the movie, but there's nothing quite like Saint Maud. There's nothing like Love Lies Bleeding. Like it is very much.
And that's, you know, obviously we're trying to remind people that this is a singular film, but yeah. You know, if somebody is like, okay, that was a great dinner. What am I going to have for dessert? Where would you point them?
If I had to pick one to be like, for some reason, these are speaking to me as being an interesting double feature.
Sure.
The movie was originally called February when it was doing the festival circuit. And then it was later renamed to The Black Coat's Daughter. It stars Emma Roberts and Kiernan Shipka. And it's set at a girls' boarding school over the Christmas break. So you've kind of got like a holdover situation with these two girls who aren't going home and they have to stay. Stuff happens. This is one of those movies that you just kind of have to go in and experience and feel. Similarly to Saint Maud, mm-hmm. It pulls on the odd imagery here and there, but it is still wholly unique and its own nightmare fuel. And you will be wondering what's what and gotcha. Why is it that way? You know, what is reality? What is not reality? Is there possession? Is there free will? Is this a deranged psychopath? Is this someone who is victim to their own trauma? Or is this someone who is demonically possessed?
Yeah.
What is going on? And also very Catholic and dealing with all of that symbolism as well as some queer symbolism that is in there as well. Like it's, to me, it falls in a similar category as Saint Maud,
okay.
which immediately makes me think of Love Lies Bleeding because there's that fearless feminine energy that is horrific in its conviction. And that is yes, give me more.
Oz Perkins is the director that you were looking for. Oz directed right. Gretel and Hansel a few years yep. ago.
He was in Legally Blonde.
He was. I will have to go looking for this because I have not seen The Black Coat's Daughter. That's one of the things I love about doing the show. I love when that happens. One more film that I think we can talk about. And I mean, in some ways, I thought it was the obvious comparison. But in some ways, it's my favorite thing of two very, very different ways to look at a similar story. Was I'm really interested now that I've seen Love Lies Bleeding in going back to Bound.
I have still never seen Bound.
I will really enjoy having that conversation after I've seen Bound. For all kinds of reasons. I mean, like, number one, it's another movie that was notoriously extremely horny. It's another movie where there is a crime that is backstopping this queer relationship. It's another one where one thing leads to another. It's not just girl meets girl, you know, and then the crime happens. It's things kind of happen along the way.
It's another neo-noir too.
It is another neo-noir. That's another reason why I was thinking about it. It's less of a reactionary crime. Like the thing is, Love Lies Bleeding is what you could call a crime of passion. Whereas Bound is a crime of opportunity. What is really interesting now, and this is not something that I can read too far into myself, although I'm sure that there's a lot of reading into it out there that I could do, and if anybody's got a link, please flip it to me, is that it would be interesting to look into it as a film that was told by two brothers who are now two sisters. Because this is the first Wachowski movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting. Like the Wachowski's entire canon, I think, has all these new layers and contextual elements to it, given, you know, who the Wachowski's are. I was going to say who they were when they started, who they are now, but that's incorrect because it's who they always were.
Exactly. Right? Yes.
Which is, and just having that additional context public mm-hmm. is fascinating to recontextualize their stories. So Bound is one that I think would make a great double feature, You know, as I said, like, you could call it the horny double feature if you want, because Bound is very, very horny. And it is another neo-noir, and it has a lot of common threads. And yet, at the same time, it's not like, you know, when we were saying that there's a difference between homage and ripoff, I don't think that she was ripping off Bound when she made this in any way, shape, or form. But I believe she had parts of Bound on her mind.
I don't think it would be possible not to. Bound in and of itself was singular for its time as well. And in a very different way, but Bound is the only, there is no other Bound.
No.
There is only Bound.
Yes. Like it's having, an adverb now, right?
Yes.
If you say it's very Bound, then, oh yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's.
You haven't even seen it, and yet if I say it's very Bound, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Now, granted, this is my profession, so I should know that even if I haven't seen it. It's kind of like not knowing. That to me feels like, you know, not knowing the ending of Carrie.
I mean, listen.
And like, even if you haven't seen the movie.
There's a lot of films, okay? There's only so many hours in the day. I don't think that you haven't seen Bound for lack of effort. What I love about these movies is sometimes they give us the push. In a direction, you know, like we'll think to ourselves, oh, you know what? I've never watched any Fassbender. That movie had Fassbender written all over it. I should watch some Fassbender. And you watch three or four and you go on your little Fassbender bender. You know, you check off a few boxes. So if Love Lies Bleeding points you towards Bound, you are welcome, by the way. If Love Lies Bleeding points you towards stuff like Bound or revisiting Blood Simple or going back to Mulholland Drive or even just watching St. Maud for the sixth time, then that's not a bad thing, right?
So with the Wachowskis, what I love about that movie in this context, particularly with what you brought up about their collective coming out as trans women, and their eventual transition and how they have been there for each other as sisters. The beautiful thing about art is that no matter how many times you've seen something or taken it in or consumed it, however, it changes every time.
Mm-hmm.
It remains exactly the same. Nothing about the actual art itself changes, but you do. Yeah. And when you do, that makes everything different. That's the case with something like Bound as well, because they weren't fully realized as themselves yet.
Yeah.
They were still coming of age in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a way for them to put their fantasies into the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so is this. So is Love Lies Bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of putting Rose Glass's fantasies out into the world in a way that she feels comfortable with, in a way that she is confident in. And thankfully, eventually, the Wachowskis were able to
embrace who they are.
Yeah. And I don't even want to say that they felt safe to do that, because I guarantee you they didn't.
No.
And they probably still don't.
Yeah. And yet, but, you know, they're generous enough to give us Things like Bound, things like Cloud Atlas, things like the Matrix movies, things like Sense8, that have pieces of themselves in them for us and for people like them who will follow and see things in these movies that otherwise wouldn't. Well, there we go. That is an incredible episode to end off my little run here before I go on vacation. It's episode 324 of the Matinee Cast. I am so bloody thankful that Ariel was able to come by and join me. Come on back Monday, April 8th for volume one of Playing Favorites. We're going to talk about Nomadland, my favorite film of 2020. If you want to catch up with it between now and then, it is on Disney Plus. Anything you would like to plug or anywhere people can follow you if they want to hear more of your insights?
If you enjoy following me on Twitter or Instagram at AFIS8, AFIS8, you can also find me on Blue Sky at the exact same handle, because I am no longer on, I mean, I'm technically on Twitter, but who's really on Twitter anymore? And you can find me on
books and links. That's it.
And you can find me on TikTok as well. Should be the same. Or it's 08. I don't remember. But yeah.
Do it. You'll be better.
Find me everywhere. I'm working on a book.
find her. Your life will be better for it. My site is thematinee.ca. For more audio content, you can find back episodes there. You can also find them in all the usual places: Apple, Google, Spotify, Pocket Cast, you name it. You can get alerts when new episodes drop. Subscribe for free. Feedback on Love Lies Bleeding can be left in the comment section of the site. You can email me, ryan@thematinee.ca. I am on Twitter, sorta, matinee_ca, and there's still Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. Any final thoughts, Miss Fisher?
Be gay, do crimes.
Here, here. For Ariel, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee.